Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there a uniquely American brand of mental illness? In the same way that we export the American way of life in the form of movies, music, and consumer products, evidence suggests that we have also spread our understanding of psychological problems to other parts of the world. And while few would argue that science informs contemporary American views on mental health, my guest today insists that they are also deeply affected by culture, and the jury is still out on whether our approach is healthier for or even kinder to those who suffer. Author Ethan Waters explores the issue in his new book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Ethan, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show.
How is America's understanding of mental illness in the 21st century unique in the world?
Well, we have a tremendous lead in the rest of the world in terms of how we categorize these ideas, how we think about them, how we think about them as biomedical notions of the mind. We help the world learn about our ideas, how to categorize, how to treat. And in the process, because mental illnesses are attached to culture and attached to how you think about them, it makes a difference how you think about a depression or a PTSD in terms of how it's manifested. The thesis of the book is that as we export our treatments and our ideas and our categories, we're actually shifting the diseases themselves to an American form.
So that they actually feel different for the people who have them.
Absolutely. They actually feel different. The experience, because it's tied up in culture and because our cultural influence is so heavy in the rest of the world in terms of mental health and healing, that we're actually shifting these ideas to an American form.
And I want to stress here, you are not saying at any point that mental illness is not real here or anywhere else or that there isn't a biological component.
That's right.
It's just an issue of the way we view it.
That's a very important point to make. You know, my wife is a psychiatrist. She does employ drugs. There are effective drug treatments, certainly in the offing. And it's important to note that this is not a matter of there not being mental illness, something like mental illness, there is biological basis for these things as well, but as the mind becomes unstuck, whether that's because of a biological change in the chemistry of the brain or because of a bad experience, the mind immediately looks to culture to understand how should I express this internal distress. And there's no one way for that to happen. And if you look across history, say, for instance, to Victorian-era Europe, where thousands upon thousands of women expressed their unconscious distress through the symptoms of hysteria, things like hysterical leg paralysis, very dramatic symptoms, right? This is not a matter of women at that time faking those symptoms. This is a matter of the troubled mind looking to cultural cues to understand the mind and then, in response, shaping the expression of a mental illness so that it is understood as a sign of distress, in the language of distress for a particular culture in a particular time. So these things really do change over time, and if you look across cultures, you can also see different expressions of mental illness. And it really does come down to a matter of how a particular culture understands the human mind and thinks about the human mind, and then the expressions of those mental illnesses sort of come through those notions. So they're very malleable and they very much change over time.
You have a really dramatic example here that was observed by a doctor in China called Sing Li. There was a girl, a teenage girl, who died of anorexia. Can you talk about what happened before and after this event?
Absolutely. So before that event in 1994, there was a local notion of a local expression of anorexia, very rare, like just a handful of anorexics. But it really didn't look like the American form of the disease. It didn't have fat phobia, for instance. It didn't have the body dysmorphia that we come to think about it. It happened in a poorer population than we think about it happening in the West, slightly older women. So it was very much a different expression. Then in 1994, a young woman walking on a downtown street in Hong Kong collapsed and died, and she was clearly an anorexic. And the press, because of the dramatic, sort of her dramatic death in the middle of the town, the press needed to explain what had happened. So and what they basically did is they went to Western experts, again, because we lead the world in our notions of mental illness, and we've had anorexia in our culture much more prominently. They went to Western experts to explain this disorder, and Western experts were glad to tell them what it was. And they said, this is what this disease looks like, this is the form it takes, these are the ancillary symptoms, this is the population that will be at risk. And it was only after that moment in 1994 that you saw a rise of the disorder in Hong Kong, and not only a rise of the disorder, but a rise of the American version of the disorder. So the fear is, not only can we export something like an eating disorder through our cultural fashions and our movies and our celebrities and so forth, but that the idea of anorexia itself, when it is placed in an insecure population, and that was a particularly uncertain time for Hong Kong because it was after the dramatic events of Tiananmen Square and before the handover to Chinese sovereignty. When you place an idea like that into a population that's looking for ways to express a general anxiety or general psychic distress, that suddenly you have what they call a new symptom in the symptom pool for a time. You have the unconscious mind might be more likely after that moment to gravitate towards something like restricting eating as a way to express this, you know, inchoate and hard to define distress in the mind.
And you know for a fact, and it's been documented, that this is not simply a case of suddenly better diagnosis was available and this whole population of very thin girls were suddenly identified. They didn't exist before.
They didn't exist before, and you can make that argument a lot. You know, it's a lot more persuasive when you make that argument with something like depression, like, oh, they didn't recognize it before. Well, in fact, with eating disorders, it's very hard not to recognize a woman who's starving herself to death. And even if you didn't identify it with the word anorexia or the Chinese phrase for anorexia, you could still go back, as Sing Lee did, into those hospital records and look for women who are self-starving, you know, or women who are starving themselves. And that's, you know, so it is pretty clear that it was a very rare disorder before the 1990s, and something happened in the middle of the 1990s to both change the prevalence of the disorder and the way the disorder was expressing itself.
Let's talk about how we decide in this country, in the medical community, about what is normal and what's not. The American Psychiatric Association has this thing, which amounts to a checklist, essentially, called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the DSM is really tremendously influential around the world. It is the way Americans diagnose and categorize mental illnesses. And, you know, in the back of the DSM, there's a small section called culturally bound syndromes. And they talk about things like that appear in other cultures that don't appear in the rest of the world, things like amok in Southeast Asia, where an incident of social distress or social insult will be followed by a period of brooding that's followed by a period of murderous rage and followed by a period of amnesia. And there's things like koro, which is this debilitating symptom also in Asia of the belief that your genitals are retracting into your body and are going to cause your death. But besides that little section in the back of the DSM, there's this premise that everything else that we categorize as mental illness is somehow beyond culture. And I think anthropologists who study cross-cultural psychiatry would suggest that the DSM itself is laden with cultural assumptions about the human mind. And the way we categorize them and the way we put symptoms together into categories actually helps shape the thing itself, and that by broadcasting our ideas about this around the rest of the world through things like the DSM itself, because it's popular all over the world in terms of diagnosing mental illnesses, that we're actually shaping the thing itself.
Now, we'll talk in a few minutes about the idea that there is money to be made by doing this, but in some cases, this happens as a result of what start out to be very good intentions.
The best of intentions. Yeah, one chapter tells the story of our interventions after the tsunami in Sri Lanka and our idea that we could rush in there with our notions of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and our ideas about critical incident debriefing and counseling just after an event. And I have to say this chapter has taken on new significance given that we're all, in all likelihood, going to do
the same
similar
thing in
set
Haiti.
Of interventions in Haiti in a couple of weeks. And certainly the counselors that went there, you know, often did so on their own dime, often did so thinking that they were really going to help out this other culture that was in need. But there's problems when you rush into another culture, especially one like Sri Lanka that has a 30-year history of a civil war. The symptoms, you know, symptoms of psychological trauma are shaped by the culture. Meaning matters, how you ascribe, what meaning you ascribe to the event and what you think is going to happen to you matters a great deal. And it also matters sort of fundamental ideas about how you think about the human self. If you ask an American, where does your psychological trauma exist after an event, they will likely point to their head. It's in my brain chemistry. I've been made sick by this event, but it's in my head. And when anthropologists sort of study Sri Lankans, for instance, you ask them where does their damage exist after the event, they're likely to say, to talk about their inability to fulfill their social role or the damage that's been done to their social group. This is a fundamental difference between sort of an egocentric version of the self and a sociocentric version of the self. And neither of those ideas are right or wrong, but they are both connected to culturally appropriate ways to heal. So for the American to go take time away and talk to a counselor, take time away from their social responsibilities to heal and talk to a counselor makes perfect sense because that's how we believe it works. For a Sri Lankan to go and take time away from their social responsibilities would seem bizarre because fulfilling their social responsibilities is an expression of their mental health. So again, it's not a bad or good, but it's culturally distinct. And when we rush in there, especially when we rush into places with, you know, 2 weeks' notice, we tend to not understand these differences and just, you know, make a mess of things.
Ethan Waters is my guest. We're speaking this hour about his new book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We're going to pause now for just a couple of minutes. I am joined by Alan Roberts. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Chris.
We are in the middle, or maybe at the beginning of, but hopefully in the middle of our winter membership campaign. We're asking everyone who listens to this show, who listens to this station, to call us at 1-888-694-6931 and make a pledge of support to KERA.
You know, Chris, I'm glad to be here during one of the best shows on the radio, certainly one of the best shows here on KERA. Listeners who are listening right now know that. 12 to 2 is appointment radio for them. They tune in every weekday to hear your program, to hear the in-depth conversation, the great guests, and the intelligent programming that you can only find here on public radio. Now, everybody who's been listening for a long time to KERA, again, they know all this. They know that All Things Considered and Morning Edition and Think are special programs. It's unique programming. And if you agree with me, and most of you do because that's why you're listening right now, give us a call right now, 1-888-694-6931.
You can also go online and make the contribution at kera.org. You know, it's really a luxury, given the way the media works today, Alan, to have an hour for each conversation. And I think those of you who listen really respond to that because you can get into a subject in depth. We hear often from our guests that it's nice to have a whole hour as opposed to having to try and take something that's really complicated and get it done in 3 minutes or a minute and a half. That luxury is made possible by your support. The people who listen and believe that this is what should exist and this is how you want to understand things, call 1-888-694-6931 and make a contribution.
And this is a partnership. It's a partnership between us and the listeners. You expect us to be here every day. You expect Chris to be in her chair at 12:01, ready to do her show every day. You expect it to be on the air, and you expect the Think producers to be ready for this show. And if we expect you to come to us a few times a year and make your pledge of support, 1-888-694-6931. Safely and securely at KERA.org.
We're still working on that new number that we had the old one all memorized. Again, you can go to KERA.org. If you're interested in a thank you gift, we have copies of Ethan Waters' new book, Crazy Like Us. You make a contribution of $120 or more, and you can choose that as your thank you gift if you want it. Of course, you can also go to the store right this afternoon and pick up a copy. It's fascinating reading. But we would ask that you still make a contribution to KERA. You choose the amount that works within your budget. You even choose how to pay for it, whether you want to do a credit card or debit card contribution or set up a sustaining membership, which is basically just a little sort of monthly contribution from here on out. Again, the number 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Ethan Waters. His new book is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. If you're ready to make your contribution to KERA, perhaps choose this as a thank you gift. The number is 1-888-694-6931. Ethan, we spoke before the break about the benevolent efforts that sometimes have consequences that are unintended. There is also, though, you've documented it here, a very deliberate attempt by drug companies to expand their markets by expanding the definitions of mental illness.
Right, by having other countries adopt the definitions that we use that fit with our drugs. And the story I tell in the book is about the introduction of Paxil, the antidepressant Paxil, in Japan 10 years ago. And it was very interesting. Japan did not share Americans' notion of depression. They did have a clinical idea of depression, but it was called endogenous depression. It was considered a very rare and very severe form of mental illness. And that's not to say they didn't have other forms of sadness and melancholy in the culture, but they put them in different cultural boxes, different cultural conceptions. In fact, you can very much make the case that Japan is a deeply sad culture. It venerates states of sadness, thinks of them as oftentimes moral compasses by which you find meaning in your life. So no one introduced an antidepressant in Japan in the 1990s. This was the same time that Prozac was the best-selling drug the world over, because the companies didn't think that Japan shared our ideas about depression, and they didn't think anyone would buy the drug, and very few people would prescribe it. So, at the end of the 1990s, GlaxoSmithKline turned its attention to changing Japan's notion of depression, changing how the country thought about this. And they actually enlisted many of the cross-cultural psychiatrists, the knowledge, of these academics who understand how culture shapes mental illness. They took them to the conferences. They fed them, with remarkable, they treated them like royalty, because they employed them to figure out this puzzle that was worth potentially billions of dollars. And indeed, they learned a great deal from the cross-cultural psychiatrists, and they began to employ this, what some of the psychiatrists now call a mega marketing campaign, this enormous assault on the idea of depression in Japan, with the intention of moving the line between where the normal and where the pathological was. And indeed, they managed to do that. They sold something along the lines of $100 million worth of Paxil that first year in Japan, and it's gone up vastly since then. And indeed, the psychiatrists who chart this in Japan are just stunned by the public change in perception about where sadness becomes mental illness. And indeed, we've exported our standard of that very successfully to Japan.
And I guess just a decade into this campaign, it's really even still too early to gauge exactly how this is going to shift Japanese culture as a whole.
Very much so. I mean, I think the people that chart this think that the change goes very deep. This is not just talking about depression or what the criteria for depression are. This is changing a culture's sense of their self. This is going very deep into changing how people view the world and think about themselves in the world. The executives of these drug companies often talk in terms of evolving other cultures. And they say, well, Japan is 10 years behind America, and China is 5 years behind Japan. And the evolution they're talking about is always towards the American model, the idea that we're in the lead for these ideas in the rest of the world, and people need to become more like us. And they're becoming extremely effective, and they see their job almost as helping that evolution along. And they're becoming extremely effective at it as they go from culture to culture and do this.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Ethan Waters. The new book is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Let's go first on the phone to Larry in Fort Worth. Hi, Larry.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, when your guest was describing the sort of the rise of American-style anorexia in China, it sounded eerily like the Salem witch trials to me. Population under pressure, and then somebody gives them a description of how to deal with it. And my question is, when America puts together, American psychiatrists or whatever, put together diagnostic tools. Like, for example, what I'm thinking about specifically is the alcoholism checklist that they use for to determine if a person is an alcoholic. Is there any consideration of the cultural implications of that checklist? My thought is that the answer is no, because one of the questions is, do you drink before 5 p.m., which in some cultures, you know, would be considered perfectly normal. And there's another one that says, have you ever done something out of character when you drank? Which, if you go to Japan, that's sometimes why they drink, so that they can do something that they wouldn't normally. And I just wonder if the psychiatric profession has any, you know, desire to look for cultural biases in their instruments. And I'll take that offline.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I do think that first comment about the Salem witch trials is, you know, you look back in time and you can see these things as a different expression of mental illness. You look back into the 16th century, for instance, in Germany and so forth, most mental illnesses were conceived of in terms of sin and possession and so forth. So, and very clearly you have, once you have that conception in the mind of a population, you have a different expression for the unconscious mind has a different expression because it is prone to thinking about the language of suffering in its moment in time, and that's a very good example, I think. And, you know, ultimately, I don't think the American mental health profession is very good about thinking cross-culturally about these things. We, you know, the diagnostic statistical manual is largely made in America, and it's largely made through a process of consensus among, you know, experts in the field. And you know, alcoholism and the definition for that is one of the things that people point to and say, that's a particularly American idea about these criteria, and they would not fit in other cultures, and they would not draw the line between normal and pathological in the same way they do here. So the answer, you know, and again, the point is not that we have it wrong and the rest of the world has it right, but that we have it different than the rest of the world, and those differences matter when it comes to thinking of yourself, and they matter particularly when it comes to how the people around a mentally ill person would look at them and think about them. You know, those differences make a great deal of difference.
You mentioned Germans in the 16th century looking at certain forms of mental illness and assuming that they must be due to demonic possession. There's something similar at work today in Zanzibar, but it's really remarkable the way the people who are suffering from mental illness there are treated. They are not exorcised and sort of punished and shunned. They're embraced by the community.
That's right. I followed an anthropologist who studied schizophrenics in Zanzibar down to the island. And talked with her about this. We would assume in the West that those notions of spirit possession would be horribly stigmatizing, that we could certainly replace our notions of the biomedical conception of mental illness, and that would undoubtedly be helpful to the sufferer. But when you look at how these narratives are employed, they're actually not, for the most part, stigmatizing. They often are used to keep the ill person within the group, within the story of the population. Pretty much everyone, you know, huge percentage of the population in Zanzibar believes in some form of spirit possession, and this idea is used to keep the ill individual within the group to care for them. It actually turns out to be a very valuable narrative. I don't believe in that narrative myself. I don't think it's true, but we have to look at these things not just from whether they're true or not, but how they play out in the interaction between us and mentally ill people. And within the mind of the mentally ill person themselves. And this may indeed be one of the reasons why the World Health Organization found in a 30-year study that schizophrenics in developing nations and traditional cultures tended to do better over time, not just a little better, but a lot better over time than schizophrenics in developed nations and in the West.
And in some cases, this is without benefit of drugs or any kind of medical therapy. They're simply taken care of by the people around them.
That's right, and they're taken care of in what psychiatrists, cross-cultural psychiatrists call very low-expressed emotion environments. There is not a lot of criticism directed at the ill person or not a lot of overly concerned about their mental state. There tends to be a little resignation in these cultures, oftentimes because these cultures deal with sickness much more often than we do in the West. There's not this hyper-attention paid to the ill person. And, you know, that may be, again, one of the reasons why they tend to do better over time, because there's not that added level of emotion, added level of criticism in the mind of the disturbed person.
Yeah, and the person retains an identity separate and apart from his or her disease.
That's exactly right. So we have this idea, you know, that if we spread our biomedical notion of mental illness around the world, that will reduce stigma. And unfortunately, when you study the adoption of that belief, that mental illness is just like any other medical illness, you find that stigma often increases. People who come to believe that it's genetic or biological think of the ill person as more permanently broken, as more dangerous, as more unpredictable. They want more social distance from that person. So this idea that we have that, you know, the biomedical notion about mental illness is a way to get around stigma actually proves to be not true at all, even as it's employed in the United States.
Yeah, you have a really interesting study in which participants were told by one of the people who were participating in the study as a running the study, the person would say, yes, I have a mental illness, and either say, I have it because of some things that happened to me when I was a kid, or they would present it as a medical condition. And in almost every case, when they said it was a medical condition, they were treated worse by the study subjects.
They were treated, the participant could give the other person, the mentally ill person, feedback through mild or electric shocks, and the people that believed that it was a medical, biomedical condition were more likely to increase those shocks next to the person that said, I have a mental illness because of something that happened to me as a kid. So there you have two explanations for mental illnesses. We think the biomedical explanation decreases stigma, but when it actually plays out in our interactions with a mentally ill person, the opposite tends to be true.
Ethan Waters is my guest. His new book is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. You can join the conversation now by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. Another important number this afternoon is 1-888-694-6931. That is the number that you call to make a contribution to KERA. You can also go online and do it at kera.org. Alan Roberts is back. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Chris. Still waiting on your phone call this afternoon at 1-888-694-6931. And this is, the fourth or fifth day into our pledge drive. We started last Friday, and you've been listening since last Friday and thinking to yourself, I'm gonna pledge one of these days. I'm going to go online, or I'm going to call the number, and I'm going to pledge, and you haven't done it yet. It's Wednesday already. We're trying to wrap this thing up. We're trying to stay on track. We're trying to keep the momentum going, and we're only going to be able to do that if you make your pledge of support right now at 1-888-694-6931, safely and securely at kera.org.
I know exactly how this goes. You think to yourself you're going to do it, as Alan mentioned, and then things happen, and then it still sort of eats away at you. You can't forget about it. We did a show, by the way, last week about procrastination. So,
mm-hmm.
But you can't forget, and then once you do it, you feel great. You think to yourself, okay, I'm right with KERA. I know that I've just helped another great year of programming continue. I know that the station only exists because people who listen make a contribution. The number to call to join that group that now feels great and can relax is 1-888-694-6931.
And $106,000 raised so far, and we want to thank all of our listeners out there who have contributed already to public radio in North Texas. And you know, Chris, everyone has their program. And I want to ask people out there listening, is Think your program? Remember a guest that has been in this studio right here that you've listened to and you couldn't get out of the car because you wanted to listen to it, a conversation you couldn't get enough of. How much is that worth to you? Is it worth it? We're not trying to make people feel guilty. We're trying to come up with an amount that you feel comfortable with this afternoon that you think that it's worth, that this radio is worth to you. 1-888-694-6931. KERA.org.
And the truth is, you know, we don't feel guilty and we don't want you to feel guilty because this is simply a service that you consume. When you go to the dentist, you are not shocked when the dental person at the front desk says, okay, that'll be $75 for your teeth cleaning. You're not shocked when you pick up your clothes at the dry cleaners because a service has been performed for you and you consumed it. We would ask that you think about it this way. We are asking every person who listens to KERA, you know, in the past, maybe somehow you came away with the impression that there was a tiny few people that were out there, or that we were going for the very wealthiest among you. And that's not the case. You know, all of us sort of give to the extent that works for our budget. It's easy and it's quick. You call 1-888-694-6931. Make a contribution. Perhaps you would like to receive a copy of Ethan Waters' new book, Crazy Like Us. That's available as a thank you at the $120 membership level.
We're here every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We ask that you come to us a few times a year and make your pledge of support to this station. This is a partnership between us and the listeners here on Public Radio in North Texas. 1-888-694-6931.
We want to say thank you to folks like Lindsay Mzhao in Arlington and Candy Crespo in Dallas, Vijay Singh in Plano, Norma Barker in Shady Shores. What a pretty name. We are happy that all of you are calling. Perhaps some of you are going online to make a contribution. You might consider setting up a sustaining membership. This is something where you set it up one time and say, okay, I'll do $5 or $10 or $20 or $50 a month, whatever amount you want to do, and then you're done. You can, in the future, if you choose to, at any time, you can adjust the amount you're contributing per month. But basically, you sort of set up a membership from here on out, so you don't even have to think about it. It's great for us because we can count on your support, and it's great for you because you don't even have to think about it when membership time comes around.
And this is unique programming. You're not going to hear this anywhere else on the radio dial. You may have tried before, but I guarantee you, you're not going to hear anything like Think. You're not going to hear anything like All Things Considered or Morning Edition. If that's worth something to you, we need to hear from you right now. 1-888-694-6931. Our phone volunteers are standing by. We need to stay on track for this hour and for this day, and we can only do that with your pledge of support right now. KERA.org, 1-888-694-6931.
If you have already purchased a copy of Ethan Waters' book, but you want a thank you gift, you might consider the Eton Emergency Radio. This is a self-powered, hand-cranked radio. It's got the AM/FM, weather channels, a flashlight, a cell phone charger. So you're sort of safe when that nasty weather that we tend to have every spring shows up. That's available when you make a contribution of $120 or more for a year-long amount of time. So if you have a $10 a month thing, we can certainly set that up. I got one of these for my parents, and I have never seen them so delighted with a little bit of technology. So if you don't want it for yourself, maybe you know someone for whom it would make a wonderful gift. The gift to you is a year of great radio. 1-888-694-6931.
$120 a month, it comes out to $10 a month. Not that much for what you get out of this program and this station. 1-888-694-6931. Online at KERA.org. We need to hear from you. If you're out there listening right now, we know this program is important to you. 1-888-694-6931.
We do our very best to make it a quick and easy transaction when you call. If you want to go online, you don't even have to talk to a human being. You can check out thank you gifts and ways to pay and membership levels. Again, our phone number, 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ethan Waters. His new book is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Our telephone number to join the conversation is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Ed in Dallas. Hello, Ed.
Hello. One of the things I'd like to agree about the medical model is that it tends to point to a pathology diagnosis, and once that diagnosis is made, then there tends to be an order of treatment that follows. One of the things I did appreciate when I was practicing as a psychotherapist was that a non-pathological approach I felt was more constructive, and in the area of Harry Stack Sullivan, or when Timothy Leary was actually serious about his work, he came up with an adaptive versus maladaptive approach that was supported by an instrument called the ICL. Wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Well, I think that where we draw the line between pathological and normal is very critical. And when we step back from our culture and look at this thing, especially when we look at it from the perspective of another culture that does not pathologize so much of human experience, it begins to look a little odd. You know, the National Institute of Mental Health says that one quarter of Americans have a diagnosable mental illness every year. Mental illness is now the number one cause of disability for young Americans. And it's pretty clear that we are indeed, you know, pathologizing and medicalizing huge swaths of human experience. And one, I think, could make the case that, you know, in the end, that trend, there's got to be an end to that trend, and that trend itself may not be the most mentally healthy. Thinking of, you know, taking on the illness role has a variety of consequences. You give up a little autonomy. You allow someone else to oftentimes to prescribe the treatment and the course of outcome. And we do that very reflexively now in America, and the rest of the world does not yet do that. So, again, evolving the rest of the world to think like us may not be the best for the mental health of the world.
Are we, Ethan, effectively creating mental illness in people in whom it might not otherwise exist? And I don't mean diagnosing symptoms in a different way, but causing them to exist.
Yeah. I think you could make this case on one level, which is that I believe a lot of the world's distress does come from a sense of disconnect, a growing disconnect from their culture, from their traditions, their beliefs, their ancestry, their religious models. Globalization itself, I think, is and the globalization of the, you know, the world economy is causing a great deal of insecurity in cultures, and I think that does lead to a certain amount of mental distress that might not otherwise be there. And then if we at that moment, say, rush in with a new way of thinking about the mind, a new way of thinking about treatment, a new way to categorize your behavior and your distress, you could step back and say, that's not actually part of the solution, that's part of the problem. We're actually, that's part of the trend that's making people feel less connected to their cultures, less connected to their traditions. And a new mode of mental health healing may indeed be engendering more psychological distress than it's fixing. Now, that said, I do think that we can go into the rest of the world with our medical advances and with our ever-improving drugs. They're not great yet, but they're certainly pointing towards a future that will be better in those ways. And we have the science of the mind that we're understanding the mind better. We should not necessarily hide that information from the rest of the world. But I think we can go into other cultures with certainly less of a heavy hand and understand that within that culture there are modes of thinking about the mind and human health that have real meaning. And indeed, since globalization is sort of an unstoppable force, we can't redraw the boundaries and these lines between cultures. We can at least hope that as these ideas mix, they go back and forth. That is, we have as much to learn from another culture about their conceptions of the mind and mental health as we do to teach other cultures about the mind and mental health.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. If you think that we stand to gain by perhaps, if not depathologizing certain things, just looking at the different ways that certain symptoms are treated in other places.
Or even looking at the ways that the human self is conceived of in other places. I mean, I came away from this book with the idea that our individualistic notion of the self in America, that we are the captains of our own destiny and we think of ourselves as somewhat, you know, potentially sort of unaffected by the world around us, that we have control over our own mind. And I think other cultures have a much more, you know, as they say, sociocentric version of the self. The self exists in your roles that you perform outside of yourself. It exists in the health of your group and the health of the people around you is an expression of your own mental health. I have to say, I feel like, you know, when you look around the world and you compare those two versions of the self, broadly speaking, I think you could make the case that that more sociocentric version of the self, that self that lies outside of the mind on top of your head, may be ultimately a healthier way to conceive of the human being.
It certainly immunizes the victim from feeling to blame if he or she doesn't get better.
That's right. That's right. So there is, you know, the rest of the world, I think, is less prone to thinking of the self as individualistic, and so less prone to blaming the individual when they go off track. They assume that thinking is wrapped up in the group, wrapped up in spiritual notions, wrapped up in all these things outside of the self that affect the self. And in America, those ideas don't sound as true to us because we have a different way of thinking about the human mind. But I think there's a great deal of value to be found, and certainly, hopefully, before we erase these differences, imposing our own ways of thinking about these things, we can have a chance to learn to understand the value of those differences.
How do you think we should assess when and where Western-style medical treatment might actually be helpful, and where it might do more harm than good?
Well, I think we have a real valid argument in promoting our science around the world. I mean, science in its best form. And the science that surrounds some of these psychiatric drugs, as you probably know, it's become very problematic. The science that surrounds SSRIs, this antidepressants, has been, you know, there's been Senate hearings about this. The drug companies have had a huge role in shaping the science. The value of these drugs, they're not valueless, but the value has been overrated by and large, and the side effects have been underrated by and large. And that's pretty clearly now in the public record. So I do think when we have scientific advances that we should present them to the rest of the world, but we need to make sure that science is not sort of fundamentally flawed by the marketplace, by the selling of these drugs. But I think America does you know, it's the place where some of the best science around the mind and mental illness is done, and that is the moment where I think we should share that information with the rest of the world. But I do think the science and the traditional, actually those ideas can, and I note in some places in the book, exist side by side. You don't necessarily need to believe in the biomedical conception of mental illness to take a pill. The pill taking and the belief in spirit possession can actually exist side by side, but only, I think, if you understand that both those ways of thinking about a mental illness might have some value.
In the same way that incidents of hysterical blindness and leg paralysis eventually tapered off in Europe, is there reason to hope that our rampant problems today in this country, particularly with things like depression, might actually recede into history at some point?
It's very interesting. They'll undoubtedly change. So you see anorexia rise and fall over time. You see notions of anxiety. That was our big thing in the 70s, 60s, and 70s. You talk about anxiety and you took a Valium, and now, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it's depression, and you take an antidepressant. You see waves of multiple personality disorder in the mid-90s surrounding the recovered memory phenomenon. These things always are in motion, and they're always changing, and I think the only way, so hopefully, you know, the worst symptoms, you know, anorexia is a horrible disease, hopefully that goes away, but it almost inevitably gets replaced by something else, because it's not the anorexia itself or the depression itself that's sparking the thing. It's, you know, that is an expression of some internal distress. So I think the only way the symptoms eventually go away is by lessening that internal distress through whatever other, you know, that's a broader, I think, cultural problem. You can't just simply rename a disease or say, now that we know that they're culturally shaped, the subconscious is no longer going to attach themselves to these ideas. That happens without our permission. It's a subconscious thing. And that's hard, very hard to get away from.
The new book by Ethan Waters is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Ethan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased you're giving away the book with the membership. And if the people that do that membership would like to contact me, I'd love to have a private conversation with them about that. I think I'm really pleased you're using that as a gift for potential members.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much, and we're delighted to have it. I really appreciate it. Thanks to all of you who have been calling over the past hour and who will continue calling or call once to 1-888-694-6931. You can also become a member at kera.org. As Ethan mentioned, we do have copies of his book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Really, really interesting. No matter where you stand on the way we're treating mental illness in this country today, it's a very unique look at the problem both here and abroad. That's available as a thank you with a $120 contribution to KERA. Or, of course, you can go buy the book and make a contribution to KERA of whatever amount you want. Alan Roberts is back. Hello, Alan. How's it going in the Pledge Central?
Things are going really, really good this hour. We're right on track, and we need to stay on track, but we can only do that with your telephone call. You still have time to make your pledge of support. You're not going to miss any of the program if you call right now. We have a nice break for
you. It's just us yammering away at
exactly.
You.
So there is time. And it doesn't take very long. I'm not saying it takes a long time. It's very quick. You can do it online or you can call 1-888-694-6931. There's still time to get Ethan Waters' book right now. That's at the $120 level. And we're not asking you to pay $120 for a book. We're asking you to help your friends, your colleagues, your coworkers, support this station, support this program, and support public radio in North Texas. That's at the $120 level for Ethan Waters' book, Crazy Like Us. We need to hear from you now.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. In the next hour, we'll be speaking to Matt Miller, who wrote this really fascinating book that's had a great deal of impact in a variety of political circles, called The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Revolutionary Thinking for a New Age of Prosperity. A lot of interesting ideas to be explored there. This is what I love about doing the show, and I hope it's what you love about listening to it, is that every day is different. There are lots of different ways to consider the issues that affect us all today. We're delighted to be able to bring you the kind of variety that exists on Think. You know, tomorrow, Alan, in this studio, a lot of people are excited about this. We have Robert Duvall coming in.
Great.
So this is the sort of thing that, because we are a station supported by listeners like you, we can have a locally promoted and produced 2-hour program every day. A lot of stations can't do this. I know that you've worked in some other markets, and it was harder to have guests of this caliber come into those places.
It is, but you know, all these stations, all these public radio stations have a local voice, and that's what real radio is. I kind of remember what real radio is. A lot of people don't anymore. Right now, real radio to younger people means local weather and local traffic. That's local radio
right.
to them. And it's not around anymore, and public radio is one of the last places that you'll find it. Here we have a local host, local issues, global issues from a local perspective here on Think. And that's something you're not going to find anywhere else on the radio dial. And a lot of you know that, and that's why you're listening right now.
It only exists because of listeners like you. 1-888-694-6931 is the number to call to make it possible. If you are a podcast listener, and we know that we have podcast listeners, not just locally, but globally, if you find something that fascinates you, please continue to allow us to make it possible. There are some costs associated with the podcast. Your support makes it possible to have Think whenever and wherever you want. You can download it and listen to it at the gym or going to pick up the kids or doing whatever it is that you do that might take you away from your radio. We're delighted to be able to bring this to you. Your support is why it can happen. KERA.org is the place to go, or you can call 1-888-694-6931.
I like to think of public radio as kind of a club. It's a secret club that us listeners know about. And when you hear people who don't know about these programs, you kind of feel sorry for them because they're definitely missing out. And that's why the people that are listening right now, you listeners know that this station is special. You're part of the club. You're part of the partnership that is public radio. This is intelligent, informative. It's subjects that are important to you. We cover issues that matter to you. Join with your friends and your colleagues and your family right now and become a member. If you're not already a member, renew your membership right now at 1-888-694-6931. We'd love to hear from you.
If you are a member, I want to say thank you. If you're already a sustaining member or you've just made the contribution, we really appreciate it. And if we could shake your hand and speak to each one of you individually, we would do that. It's much more efficient to do it this way. We do ask, though, that you consider evangelizing for public radio. If you are a member and you're on Facebook or MySpace or Twitter, let everybody know that you are a member. And you might just convince some of your friends that it's a cool thing to do and that it matters and that it's important to you. You have a great deal of influence over the people in your life. So if you're already a member, please try to spread the word for us.
And the face of radio is changing, and KERA is changing along with it, not only with the podcast, but with the Twitter and being on Facebook. We're trying to keep up with all the trends, and we're doing it, and it's only through the support of listeners like you. 1-888-694-6931. How about a donation of $60, $100, $500, whatever you can do, whatever is important to you, how you decide what this program means to you and how much you should donate. 1-888-694-6931. We'd love to hear from you right now.
You know what I thought was really cool, Alan, was when Diane Reams started asking for tweets on the air.
Yes.
I was like, this is a hip, you know, kind of, you know, Diane Reams.
She knows
right
about
there.
It.
She does. She's all over it. And, you know, we are trying to serve you in as many ways as possible. That's why we have a really significant online component now. And you may have checked out our Art and Seek website. You hear the little blurbs on the radio, but there's a lot more online. We serve you online. We serve you here on the radio. We give you podcasts. We try to be there in every form you want. The only thing we really need from you besides your listening and paying attention is your money. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You might consider becoming a day sponsor. This is such a cool thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm sorry, Chris. I can't really read.
Yeah, you basically give $365. That's the, you know, a dollar a day. That's why we call it a day sponsor. And then you get these three on-air messages, not a commercial message, but you can say, happy birthday, or will you marry me, or I love baseball or whatever you want to say, three messages on a particular day, and that's the thank you gift that comes along with a day of sponsorship. Such a unique thing, if no other thank you gift is anything that you might be interested in.
We'd like to thank Mary McLean in Dallas, also David Miller in McKinney. Thank you so much for making your pledge of support to this program this afternoon. And there's still time for you, still time to get Crazy Like Us by Ethan Waters at the $120 level. That's a thank you gift this afternoon for making your pledge of support for public radio in the South Plains.
Thanks.
The phone number to call, 1-888-694-6931.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.